All right. So I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. And I think we can get ready to officially launch our session. So I'm going to add a speaker here to join us in the spotlight. And I will turn the floor to Emmy Laiha from the Federal Facilities Office to introduce you to the ongoing Academy.
All right, thank you so much, Jean. Hi, everyone. I'm Emmy Laiha with our Federal Facilities and Restoration Reuse Office here at EPA. Just want to take a second to plug our Federal Facilities Academy. So what the Academy is voluntary training, but it's really focused on the nuances of cleanup under CERCLA at our federal facility sites. There's a total of 11 webinars, one of which you're participating in today. Please note these are archived, so you can go back to them at a time that's convenient for you if you're not able to participate live, or if you missed a session already, and still be able to get credit for them. We also have a 3-day classroom training. The preferred method for that training is in person. However, we are considering offering that online so more people can participate. But once you complete all of these trainings, that will help you get a better understanding of the, again, the nuances of federal facility cleanups, you'll receive a certificate of completion from our federal facilities director. And we can copy your management so that they're aware you're putting in that extra time and energy to really understand the CERCLA process at our federal facility sites. Oh, Jean, you're on mute.
I was on mute. There we go. All right. So thank you, Emmy, for that brief overview for the series. I do want to remind everyone methods for participating and documenting your participation in each of the courses that are part of this academy. So as Emmy stated, there will be 11 webinars that will be hosted live online and open to the public. You can participate in the online webinars by attending them live, just as you're doing today, or you can replay any or all of the webinars online after they've been hosted live. For that in-person 3-day classroom training, the only way to participate is to attend in person, and that is open to a restricted audience. So it's only open to EPA states, tribes, and other federal agencies. Now, as you take each of the individual online webinars, whether you take them live or replay the recorded versions, you'll be able to submit feedback and receive a participation certificate for each of the online Academy sessions. Whether you do them live or replay the recording, you can document and get a certificate for each of them. And then if you participate in all of the 11 online sessions together, again, whether you do it live, you replay them online, or some mixing and matching of both methods, if you're also able to attend that in-person Academy as well, you'll then receive the Academy certificate, which reflects the fact that you completed both the online components and that in-person classroom delivery. If you have any questions about the certificate process or how to document attendance, you can feel free to send me an email directly at ballant.jean@epa.gov. So with that, Emmy, I think we're ready to formally launch into the presentation materials.
Now I was muted. That sounds good, Jean. Let's go ahead and get started. All right, 1 second, folks. I'm going to get our slides up and on screen. And remember that you can download that PDF that we shared in the chat earlier to follow along. We'll have all the links and resources that we mentioned will be available in that PDF. So let's go ahead and get started. We are going to be looking at community involvement at federal facilities. And to be honest, this is one of my favorite topics in the Federal Facilities Academy. So we'll be looking at what the lead agency role is, different levels of community involvement, and requirements for community involvement through the NPL listing, removal actions, and remedial actions, and then what might be required post record of decision at your sites. And we'll finish up looking at some tools that might be able to help you as you're going through this process at your cleanups. So let's start off with the lead agency role. With the lead agency, we turn to the NCP, the National Contingency Plan, that states the lead agency is the one that provides on-scene coordinators and remedial project managers. So at federal facilities, if you're looking at a Department of Defense or Department of Energy site, for example, those agencies are the ones providing the OSC and the RPM. For other sites, other than those of EPA, the Coast Guard, DOD, and DOE, then that other agency will be the lead agency for remedial actions and removal actions outside of emergencies. So sometimes you hear this referred to as the lead cleanup agency, which tries to get into that, the different roles we play as regulatory agencies versus the lead cleanup agency. So how does that relate to community involvement? Well, at these federal facility sites, be it DOE, DOD, Department of Interior, what have you, for their federal facility sites on the NPL, that other federal agency is the lead agency, not only for cleanup, but also for community involvement. EPA is conducting regulatory oversight there, and that also includes ensuring that all the community involvement requirements in the NCP are met. But to a greater extent, it's also making sure that the intent to involve the public in the decision-making process under CERCLA is also being met. So that's a bit of a larger role that's not necessarily laid out in the NCP. At the end, it's not on one agency or the other, be it EPA, the state, or another federal agency to do good public involvement. It really takes the effort of all agencies involved at cleanup at a site to produce great community involvement opportunities for the affected public and our cleanup decisions. So definitely keep that in mind. When it comes to, well, what document do I look at? Is it the NCP? Is it something else? NCP definitely is very important, but we'll talk about a lot of those requirements today. Also, your federal facilities agreement for your site. That is going to have specific information and possibly additional requirements beyond what's in the NCP for community involvement at your sites. Remember, they're site specific, so be familiar with that FFA. Look at the different requirements throughout the remediation process for public meetings, public notices, records of meetings. There might vary from site to site. So you really need to know what is in your FFA in addition to what is in the NCP. And your federal facility agreements aren't just for the agencies to use. It's also might be of interest to the public. You know, we have milestones with due dates and schedules as part of our federal facility agreements, and those cleanup schedules likely are going to be of great interest to the public. So it's important to be familiar with those as well. And again, I just want to highlight EPA's primary role here is providing that oversight and acting not only as advisors, but also as partners in the community involvement efforts for the federal facility site with the lead agency and state partners. All right, so one document that you're going to hear me reference a lot is the 2020 Superfund Community Involvement Handbook. This has been updated multiple times. We're actually trying to update it frequently to make sure you're not getting outdated advice on how to conduct community involvement at your sites. But we do have a chapter specific to federal facilities, and that chapter's really highlights, well, what role is EPA playing? So ensuring that all the requirements are being met, mentioned that a few times, encouraging the lead agency to advocate for early and meaningful community involvement, becoming familiar with your FFA, we just talked about that, and offering advice on how to best implement these community involvement activities and opportunities. Also, bringing community issues to the site's attention. Perhaps your project team doesn't realize that the community is concerned with a specific contaminant or airborne contamination, traveling to their homes, what have you. EPA can really be a voice to advocate for that public involvement happening throughout the cleanup process. And also, if a requirement is not being met, definitely that's on EPA to say, hey, this is not optional. This is something you have to do. One thing before we go into this next section on levels of community involvement, sometimes you'll hear, at least in my time as an RPM at a site, sometimes a lead agency would say, well, EPA, if you want to do all this community involvement, why don't you put in the resources, the money, and the people to do that? To which I would respond, Congress has appropriated money for you to do the cleanup, which includes community involvement. Thus, it's your responsibility, other federal agency, to pay for it. So EPA does typically not pay for community involvement activities at our federal facility sites because that responsibility lies with the cleanup agency. I'll talk about some exceptions, but just wanted to get that out on the table. So let's look at levels of community involvement. If we look back in history, before NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, was passed in 1969, the government definitely had a decide, announce, and defend approach to communicating with the public. This is what we're doing, this is why, and that's how it's going to be. Okay, not very allowing for the public to be involved. Then in 1980, when CERCLA was passed, it became more of informing and listening. Like, okay, we want to hear what you have to say. Here's what we're going to do. Thanks for the input. Once we got post-SARA, the amendments to CERCLA in 1986, it really started looking at providing public opportunities to influence decisions, where input on a proposed plan could actually influence the ultimate remedy that's chosen for a site. So moving to involving the public in the decision-making process. Ultimately, that's where we are at now, really integrating public concerns into our decision-making process, which ultimately ends in more buy-in from the community. I want to take just a second to talk about this spectrum of community involvement. This is adapted from the International Association of Public Participation. They have a really good graphic, and I want you to look at the first two rows here. So for the first two rows, this is stuff that we need to do, that they're part of the NCP requirements, right? So if your goal is outreach, trying to conduct outreach with your community, and you're really just trying to inform them of what's happening by providing information, we're promising we're going to keep you informed of what's happening. And we might do that through a website, fact sheet, press release. Notice this is all very much one way. But with information exchange, where we're actually looking for input from the community, there is a bit of back and forth. So you're listening to the public concerns, and that's influencing the decision that's going to be made. And this definitely falls into a lot of NCP requirements. If you host a public meeting, requirements to hold public comment, for example. So this is definitely things that we should all be aware of at our federal facility sites, but maybe perhaps you want to go further. Are you trying to collaborate with the communities or involve them in other ways? A lot of our sites, DOD and DOE, which we'll talk about more later, have citizen advisory boards specific to those agencies. That's another way that you're really able to go further than just an information exchange and really take in recommendations from citizen groups. All right, so I will again, just here highlight this information exchange being a big part of how we conduct community involvement under CERCLA. And let's switch gears now to community advisory boards. I'm actually going to hand it over to Cal to talk more about those.
Okay, let's talk advisory boards. Next slide, please, Emmy. So community involvement at federal facilities often involves the creation of some type of community advisory group. On the DOD sites, these are referred to as Restoration Advisory Boards, or RABs, and at DOE sites, they are called Site-Specific Advisory Boards, or SSABs. These advisory boards offer the local stakeholders the opportunity to participate, do a deeper dive at sites that have both remedial and removal cleanups. So RABs are typically established at DOD Superfund sites when there is sufficient and sustained community interest, and SSABs exist at several of the DOE sites. And the boards are comprised of representatives from the lead agency, from EPA, the state, any major stakeholder groups that may be present in the community, as well as just concerned citizens. And these folks are kind of committed to working together to review site plans and documents. Sometimes it involves technical assistance, but it's really a very focused effort that brings people together looking at plans collectively. Next slide, please. So DOD and EPA issued joint guidance back in 1994 on RAB implementation, and the link to this is available in your program guide. RABs are an expansion of what originally DOD had, which were called technical review committees. And so the boards are this forum for exchange of information. There may be presentations from DOD, contractors, possibly even EPA as well. And there's this opportunity for information exchange and lots of questions and requests. So it's really a neat concept, but it does require quite a bit of commitment on the part of the community members who are participating in these boards. Ideally, they bring together people from the community with very diverse interests, but that of course is predicated on going out there and finding folks in different communities to be represented. Really, when you think about it, the RAB should complement other community involvement efforts and not replace them. It works best when it is built on other outreach and engagement efforts. The RAB Rule Handbook provides more specific information on the use of RABs and how they function. This was published in 2007 as part of what's called the RAB Rule, which was published in the Federal Register. Again, that link is in your handout. Next slide, please. Okay, so at DOE sites, we're talking about environmental management sites, and they have these site-specific advisory boards, which were originally created in 1994 to involve stakeholders more directly in the cleanup decisions. Currently, there are 8 boards. They're listed on the slide. Each link is a hyperlink to their specific websites. The interesting thing about how DOE does this is the SSABs are much more formal than the DOD RABs. All activities are governed under what's called the Federal Activity Committee Act, or FACA. This was enacted to ensure that government board deliberations are open and transparent to the public. So members of the SSABs are made up of representative members of the community around DOE sites. And like I said, this is a much more formal process. It requires all meetings be open, accessible to the public. Meetings must be announced in the Federal Register. All documents are maintained for the life of the board. There's membership must represent a diversity of interests, and there's time allocated at each public meeting for public comment. And then DOE is required to formally respond to each recommendation made by the local board. So there is also a state and EPA liaison on each of the boards, and the state and EPA may make presentations, have time at board meetings as well. But again, it's much more structured, much more formal. Next slide, please. Okay, so as I alluded to, RABs and SSABs are often viewed by other federal agencies as cornerstones of community engagement, but really, like, if that's all you do, you're not going to get very far. So it's important to remember that most citizens will not want to participate on these boards, or they won't be able to because of timing, scheduling, language barriers, et cetera. So it always requires kind of this supplemental, targeted, and strategic outreach to make sure that you're capturing all potentially interested and impacted members of the community. So what we find are the boards often represent a small group of active stakeholders, and that is very useful and important. But, you know, that alone won't get the job done. So it will be much more effective if it's supplemented by other diverse outreach efforts. Next slide. Okay, this is a cute little cartoon that presents all the community involvement opportunities at each stage in the Superfund process at NPL sites. So Appendix A of the Superfund Community Involvement Handbook contains all the regulatory citations and responsible parties for community outreach. So I think that's it for me. I'm turning it back to Emmy.
All right, Cal, we're switching to the NPL listing, just making sure that's something you want me to cover. All right. So we're going to start from the beginning of the process and look at what community involvement requirements are needed there. So say we're at the very beginning of the process, and I'll admit for federal facilities, we don't often get to do an NPL listing. However, we did one quite recently for Bradford Island in Region 10. So let's talk a little bit about the requirements when you're in that stage of the process. So I'm not going to go through this graphic in a lot of detail, but it just shows like for federal facilities, those sites have to be listed on the docket. They're added to our SEMS database. It's no longer called CERCLIS. And then a preliminary assessment and if necessary, site investigation are done. But what I really want to point out here is that community involvement typically isn't starting this early in the process. So if you're doing a preliminary assessment, that really doesn't do well for involving the public in that conversation. Or even if you're doing the site inspection, it doesn't make a, you know, there's not public comment period. There's not opportunity to provide feedback or input. So this really isn't going to have required public involvement, but it is a good opportunity to start understanding your community, start identifying the different groups that you might need to work with. So in that respect, it's still a good place to get started. If the site ends up being of a high enough risk that it ultimately does rank on our hazard ranking system and is added to the NPL, then we have that more formal public comment process that'll come into effect. So as far as requirements related to the NPL listing itself, there are a few. You have to publish the proposed rule to add that site to the NPL and allow for a public comment period, then hold the public comment period of at least 30 days. And from those comments, the agency, EPA, because EPA manages the national priorities list, will have to prepare and publish a response to comments. And this is even with our federal facilities. That's a role that EPA plays, but we work with on a team always at federal facilities with the lead cleanup agency that's going to be cleaning up the site as well as a regulatory agency. So we respond to comments. And if there were any significant comments or new data that came to light, that is identified as well. And finally, if it is decision is to move forward with adding that site to the NPL, there has to be the NPL listing published in the Federal Register. So this was just a quick list. What I really like about the 2020 Superfund Community Involvement Handbook is that it has these great figures that can highlight, well, how, what should I do? What if I want to do more than the community involvement requirements in the NCP? What if you have a public that is really concerned, really vocal, and you're trying to figure out, well, how can I meet the needs of this community? Here is a great figure. It's 3-1 from that handbook, and I'll just call it the handbook from now on. So you can see anything with an asterisk is required by the NCP, so not optional. But say you are looking at additional public involvement because your public is, you know, significantly interested or curious about what you're doing, then you could maybe issue additional fact sheets or technical fact sheets for what's going on at the site. Or you create a website or perhaps a social media page that can provide regular updates outside of the what we talked about with the RABs or SSAB meetings. It could be something just more readily accessible to the public. And if it's really controversial and you everyone's trying to talk to you, you could offer workshops or webinars or other ways to engage the community. So I like this because it shows, you know, okay, here's a minimum, here's the low end to a moderate to high end of activities that can be considered based on the needs of the site. It really isn't one size fits all. You have to consider what your community needs when looking at what public involvement activities would be appropriate there. All right, so that's the NPL listing portion. Let's move forward to removal actions and those requirements. So in a removal action, you have three different types of actions. I'll go over them quickly. You have your emergency response. Action is required now. Something maybe is on fire or draining into a body of water, and there's not enough time to do a lot of community involvement or write up an action memo that will identify the actions that need to be taken to address this risk. It is urgent. We're going to act now and we'll tell you what we did later. That's how emergencies typically go. However, if you have something that's a time critical removal action, meaning you have a few months, action probably has to be taken in the next 6 months. You have time to write an action memo, say what actions are going to be taken before you start the work. With a non-time critical removal action, with the time critical, sometimes you hear these called TICRAs, you know, acronyms. We love to make things difficult. That action memo is in place before you go out on site. With the non-time critical removal action, that means you have time for planning. You have at least more than 6 months, in which case you're going to have to do an engineering evaluation and cost analysis, or its equivalent, put that out for public comment, and then after considering public comment, write the action memo and move forward with the action. So let's get into some of the specifics. I'll just caveat, each of these removal actions is going to have different requirements or different levels of requirements for community involvement. So something that applies to all of these removals are some basic community involvement actions: designating an agency spokesperson, establishing an administrative record, and informing the community about the existence of the administrative record. It's not helpful to have all this information available to the public if they don't know where it is and when they can access it. With the pandemic, a lot of these have become more available online, so people can access the administrative record and all its files from home, because a lot of these public spots were closed during COVID. So something to keep in mind. For all time critical responses with a planning period of less than 6 months, you also need to have public comment within 30 days of the administrative record being made available to the public. So that's something to consider. And also in those public comments, if there's any significant comments, you have to respond to those as well. One thing I want to note here, these are the responsibilities of the lead agency. The lead cleanup agency is establishing the administrative record and maintaining the records it contains. And EPA, as the one of the regulatory agencies, is ensuring that these requirements are met. So if you're an EPA RPM, you have to be aware of these requirements to ensure that they're being met, which is why it's so important. Perhaps there isn't a community involvement coordinator from EPA that is part of the site team. In that case, it really is falling on the RPM to know these requirements and ensure they're being met. All right, let's go forward with time critical responses that last more than 120 days. If the field work, you know, work on the ground is lasting more than 120 days, then we should be conducting, the site team or the lead agency actually should be conducting community interviews, establishing a community involvement plan. The NCP still refers to this as a community relations plan, but that terminology has been updated in everyday use. And also establishing an information repository. So this is a location where the public can go and access records that are perhaps out for public comment or other informative information. It might not be the entirety of the administrative record available at that location, but documents where there is an opportunity for the public to provide feedback is typically what you'll find. If you're dealing with non-time critical responses that have a planning period of at least 6 months, then you also need to publish a notice of the availability of the ECA once that's issued. Allow for public comment of at least 30 days on the ECA, and that can be extended by a minimum of 15 days upon timely request. So an issue I've seen at some of sites for both remedial and removal actions is, oh, well, we're just going to extend this public comment period by a week. Okay, well, a week is less than 15 days, yes? So technically, maybe you could do that and nobody would complain. But if you have a person of the public that is very aware of what the requirements are, they could say you are not adhering to the NCP. It was a minimum of 15 days for the extension. So now you have to do the entire public comment period over again. So I always want to warn people, don't mess with the days. It might be easier for your schedule, but that ultimately puts your decision at the risk of being further delayed because you're not following what the NCP says. So very important to keep in mind. And lastly, on those comments you received, that responsiveness summary needs to be placed in the administrative record. So that was a lot of information I just threw at you. How in the world are you supposed to keep A, B, and C clear, right? That's a lot of overlapping information. Again, a lovely figure from the handbook here in Table 4-1 shows you quite simply in a checkmark list, like, okay, what are the required community involvement activities for removal actions? You have for emergency removal, okay, check, check, check. You have to have it the spokesperson, administrative record, and let the public know the administrative record exists. Got it. And if you're doing with a TICRA, that time critical removal action, for those in the field less than 120 days, you see your check marks and also things that don't apply. So conducting, establishing your PIR, public information repository, establishing a community involvement plan, those things don't apply because of the amount of time you're actually doing work on the field. However, if it's more than 120 days for this work to be done, then more requirements apply. And lastly, if you're doing a non-time critical removal action, everything applies. You need to do all of these things for community involvement. And again, this isn't optional. Be careful. What I've noticed at some sites is, you know, perhaps some lead agencies want to paint something as, oh, this is a time critical removal action, but it's been something they've been aware of for years, but now it's time critical. Oh, is it because you don't want to write an ECA, put it out for public comment, and have to go through that entire process? So using time critical removal actions to circumvent the remedial process is not good practice. Remember, we do want to involve the public in the decision-making process. So if you are seeing that at your site, having a good heart-to-heart, like, is this really time critical? I'm having a hard time believing it. And the public is going to have an even greater time believing that this cleanup action after 10 years is now a critical action that has to be taken. So just some conversations to be had with your site team. All right. So that was a ton of information, but I want to see how much of it is actually sinking in. So let's have a little poll. We're going to test your understanding.
All right. So Emmy, there's going to be a new window that's about to pop up on the screen for everyone. And as I click the button to launch this poll, I will remind the audience that a new window has popped up and you'll have two options below the statement. You can indicate if you think the statement is true or false by clicking the circle next to the response and then hitting the submit button. So the statement in question, a removal is time critical when a site evaluation has been conducted and it is determined that there is not an immediate emergency, but on-site removal activity must begin within 6 months. So is that statement true or false? It looks like about half of you have sent in an answer. We do want to have a few more of you participate. There is no penalty for getting it wrong. It just helps our instructors know if they've been effective at sharing some information today. If you happen to have a viewing party going on in a conference room in your location, let's fight it out amongst yourselves and land on one answer and then hit that submit button so we can go ahead and close the poll. I'm looking at about 2/3 of you have voted. I'm going to go ahead and close the poll down now. Here's a tip. We're going to do more of these. So make sure you're engaged and ready to answer some more questions in just a moment. All right. I think we've probably gotten all the answers we're going to get, Emmy. And let me share those results. So most of the audience, about 2/3 of them, said this was true, but just over 1/3 said it was false. What's the answer?
So the answer is true. This is a time critical removal action.
All right.
Because they're saying the action has to happen within 6 months. You have less than 6 months of a planning period for this removal action. So we have a TICRA. All right, well, let's try the next question. Here we go.
Okay, so we have a new one window that's going to pop up, and this is a check the two that apply. So you should see boxes next to each option. You can click two of them and then hit the submit button. And this question is asking you which two community involvement activities are required when a removal action on-site activity takes less than 120 days. Is it A, complete a CI plan, B, establish an administrative record, C, notify the public about the availability of the administrative record. D, establish an information repository. Or E, conduct community interviews. And if you need to, you can scroll or adjust the size of that poll window if you're having a hard time reading answers, but it should spread things out. Now, it looks like about a third of the audience have sent in their answers. So remember, you're going to click two of the boxes to select either A, B, C, D, or E, and then hit the submit button. And then we'll go ahead and close this down here in just a moment and talk about those responses. And if you have clarifying questions or thoughts on these particular examples, you can always chime in a message into the Q&A. If you're unclear or you picked them all or picked one particular answer, that'll help our instructors as we're talking about the right answer. Again, it looks like we've got about two-thirds of you voting, so I'm going to end that poll and take a look at the results. So we have actually a very nice distribution. So it looks like C was the most popular, notifying the public about the availability of the AR, followed closely by B, establishing an administrative record. So they're saying C and B are most likely the two you need to do.
And that is correct. B and C are the correct answers. Establishing that administrative record and notifying the public about its existence is something you need to do. One thing I want to highlight, for many of our federal facilities, they have been around for years, potentially decades, right? And so the administrative record may have been established in those first years that the site began cleanup. One thing I want to highlight, an administrative record should not be a complete dump of all files related to all cleanup for all operable units on a site. Can you imagine trying to find a needle in that haystack? Likely not helpful at all. And if you look closely at the NCP, it doesn't say you're going to have an administrative record for a site. It says you're going to have an administrative record for that removal or remedial action. So your administrative record should be set up in a way where you can see the pertinent files for a specific action, be it removal or remedial. If you just have a catch-all administrative record of thousands of files, you are not meeting the intent of the NCP at your federal facility. So if one of your roles or your agency's roles is managing an administrative record for a site, think very hard about that, because often when I look at administrative records that are available electronically, they are not set up like that. It is just one big catch-all. And technically, that is not what the NCP is asking you to do for your sites. So keep that in mind. It is a liability. All right, let's go to the next question.
Okay, a new window. Now we're asking which activities are required when a removal action on-site activity takes more than 120 days. And so option A, complete a communications plan. B, establish an administrative record. C, notify the public about the availability of the administrative record. D, establish an information repository. Or E, conduct community interviews. So again, you'll check the boxes to the left of the answers that you think are required when a removal action on-site activity takes more than 120 days. And then hit the submit button when you are done making your choices. And then we'll talk about those correct answers. I'm seeing a trend. About a third of you have cast your vote. Oh, now we're up to about half of you. We'll wait till we get to about two-thirds of you. Again, no penalty for getting it wrong. So just do your best to guess. And we do have a clarifying question about EPA performing non-time critical removal actions, Emmy. So we might get to that in just a moment. Okay. As we're waiting for more of the audience to chime in with their answer. And one day I'm going to have great hold music to play while we wait for these answers to come in. I'm looking at about two-thirds of those responses coming in. I'll give you just a second more before I end. And then let's take a look at how the audience has voted. So let me end this poll and share those results. So here it looks like the audience definitely thought that we needed to do A, complete a communications plan. And then they seem a bit split. The next two popular options were establishing an information repository, which was D, and then E, conducting community interviews. What's the right answer?
So for this one, I think we had a little bit of a typo, because there's more than two correct answers. So if you said that the answers were B, C, D, or E, then you would be correct. Completing a communications plan is always a pretty good idea, but it isn't necessarily required for your time critical removal actions. But doesn't mean you can't do it if it makes sense and you know you're going to be communicating through the press, with the public, social media very often. It would make sense to have one. Okay, so we have one last question and then we'll move on to the next topic.
Okay, and Emmy, I think the same rule applies as this new window pops up. It's not just limited to two. They can sort of check all that apply for this one. So you'll click the boxes to the left of the answers that you think are activities that are required for a non-time critical removal action when you have a planning period of more than 6 months. So which activities are required for a non-time critical removal action with a planning period of more than 6 months? And you can select more than two. If you think it's just two, that's fine too. But if you think it's more than, go ahead and click more than. And your options are A, respond to public comments in a responsiveness summary. B, establish an administrative record. C, hold a public meeting. D, hold a public comment period. Or E, conduct community interviews. So as these answers are coming in, about half of the audience has voted, and we are starting to see, it looks like three items are more popular than the rest. And I'm going to go ahead and give you just a moment more to click all those boxes and then hit the submit button before I go ahead and close this one down and we talk about the correct answer. And so as I'm sharing these results, Emmy, it looks like almost everybody thought D, that they were required to hold a public comment period. And then most of the audience also selected A, responding to public comments and a responsiveness summary, and B, establishing an administrative record. Those were the top three responses. Anything else?
So those top three responses are correct. And so is E, conducting community interviews. The only one that is not a requirement in this case would be holding a public meeting. That is not laid out as a specific requirement in the NCP for non-time critical removal actions. It may make sense to have a public meeting to accompany your ECA and explain what's being considered, but it isn't necessarily required.
All right. Excellent.
Yes. Thank you so much to everybody who participated in our polls. We'll have more of those as we go through the course. But now I'd like to hand it back over to Cal to talk about environmental justice considerations.
Okay. Thank you. Can you hear me? I got a mute.
We can. Notice.
All right, great, thanks. So I'm going to introduce the concept of environmental justice now. So back in April 2021, our administrator directed all EPA offices to take steps to better integrate environmental justice into all of our plans and activities. And while acknowledging, you know, there's a recognition we've been doing this for years, right? This is not new, but there were some points of emphasis that Administrator Regan introduced. Among them are to strengthen enforcement of violations, to take immediate and affirmative steps to incorporate environmental justice considerations into our work, including assessing impacts to pollution-burdened, underserved, and tribal communities, to take immediate and affirmative steps to improve early and more frequent engagement with pollution-burdened and underserved communities, and to engage in regular, meaningful, and robust consultation with tribal officials in the development of federal policies that have tribal implications, and to consider and prioritize both direct and indirect benefits to underserved communities in the development of grants and award decisions. So this slide highlights, two of the factors that are most relevant to the work that we do in federal facilities Superfund sites, and that is to take action to incorporate bring the environmental justice lens to the table in our everyday work and to improve engagement and community involvement, particularly in impacted communities. Okay, next slide, please. what I'd like to emphasize here is environmental justice is about both protection and engagement, right? And these two go hand in hand. So to provide the same degree of protection, we must recognize that there are factors in some communities that may lead to disproportionate impacts. And so we have to understand community-specific vulnerabilities that may be present in the community. And then to provide the same degree of engagement, we need to tailor the outreach strategies to meet the needs of the different communities that may be present. So, and through that engagement, we learn more about the communities, the vulnerabilities, the impacts, and the context in which they're experiencing site-specific impacts. So again, it goes hand in hand. You can't have one without the other. Next slide, please. I think it's also important to consider environmental justice throughout the CERCLA process. So it's not just at the beginning when you're developing that community involvement plan, but really it needs to be woven throughout. You need to bring this lens to the table. As you're scoping the RIFS, for example, you want to understand if there may be land or resource uses that need to be considered so that you plan your sampling and analysis to capture those so that they can be incorporated into the risk assessment, right? So this has to happen early. You have to understand and learn from the community as you go along and weave this into your documentation, right? So when you get to the point where you are looking at options and deciding amongst, what you might be doing about the contamination that's present, you're not just pulling in environmental justice considerations at the end of the process, but it's been fully baked into your analysis throughout the process, right? And, you know, while this is the responsibility of the other federal agencies, EPA has a role to play. We can partner. We have a number of tools. I'll talk about some of those later in the webinar so that we can bring our expertise and experience to the table throughout all of the different processes that we go through. Next slide, please. So here are some specific actions that you can take to ensure protection of vulnerable and disproportionately impacted populations. So, use the information you glean through community engagement and other activities to understand potential land and resource use, any unique activities that could result in exposures. And of course, this is used to refine the conceptual site models. And that informs sampling and analysis so that you have the data you need to do the risk assessment, right? And so this by doing all of these things early and upfront, you ensure that the relevant exposure scenarios are included in the risk assessment so you can assess risks and determine if there are problems there. You can also consider other non-site related factors that could influence risk and provide context. So for example, if there are other polluting sources in the vicinity, it may be important to know that. It's not the responsibility of the other federal agency to address those sources of contamination, but understanding the risk context will help you make better decisions when it comes to what you do have control over. And I think we can take this opportunity to highlight important science-based information that may be qualitative and not just quantitative, and highlight that, elevate that, and carry that through to the decision-making process. Next slide, please. Okay, there are also actions we can take to improve our engagement with communities that may have environmental justice concerns. So for example, we can run desktop tools such as EJ Screen and compare you know, the findings with kind of with what we currently know about community engagement. We have lists. Every facility has lists of folks that they send mailers to. Are you missing people in that on that list? Do you need to develop strategies to engage neighborhoods that you're not currently connecting with? So they may be different strategies other than, say, a restoration advisory board. You may need to go out to different community events to reach them specifically. You can use all of this information to update the community involvement plan. It should be updated periodically. Neighborhoods change, things change, and it's important to keep that up to date and also build in new strategies and lessons learned. You can expand community understanding of the community through direct engagement, getting out there and meeting people at different community events. And, you know, this is something not only for other federal agencies, but for EPA as well. We have stature. We can convene other state and local governments and agencies to help them, help bring them to the table so we can address problems more holistically. Again, it may not be our direct responsibility, but we have the, you know, we have the pull. We can bring people together. And I think that's really important to remember. Next slide, please. Just a word about documentation. You know, we mentioned how important it is to consider environmental justice throughout the process. There's no set cookbook or SOP on how to document this. So we have to be thinking about this on a site-specific level. As we do the work, as we're working through documents, if it has an angle that involves environmental justice, we should find ways to weave this into the documentation. Again, creating the record, creating the foundation that will allow us make better decisions when it's time. So I think that's it. Emmy?
Hey, Cal, I want to pause for a second and see if any questions came in during your talk. I know this is a very big topic nationally right now. Jean, do we have any questions for Cal?
So we do have some questions that came in specifically about risk assessment and cumulative impacts that might be considered. They were wondering if we have guidance on how to integrate risk assessments with cumulative impacts. Specifically, they say that EJ communities are often overburdened with hazardous waste generators and handlers. And so then when you couple that with risks from a federal facility, how would you be incorporating that?
So we don't have specific guidance yet. We're building guidance on cumulative impacts, right? This is a hot topic, a lot of research. But what I will say is there are things we can do today. Number one, you know, make sure you understand the communities and the context in which they're living in. Number two, we have in the risk assessment guidance for Superfund, it does include guidance on both qualitative and quantitative risk. So there are ways to include in a descriptive fashion what we cannot at this time quantify. And it's important to do that, and not just as a checkbox, but to carry it forward. So you carry forward both the quantitative risk and a description of the qualitative factors that may be influential and highlight that for decision makers. And I think oftentimes this gets done, but it gets buried. So those are some things to think about. While, you know, I know it's frustrating whenever there's, you know, these important issues take time to work through the research and ultimately the development of guidance. But there are things we can do today to advance the cause. And that's what I would recommend.
Okay. Let's take a look here to see. There are some questions here about enforcement measures. So can you talk a little bit if there are enforcement measures that are available to our regulators when they're including EJ processes in their CI plans?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't have information on that, but we can take that as an action item that we can share, you know, and any available information with the group afterwards.
Yeah, the one thing I'll add, Cal, when it comes to enforcement and community involvement plans, the authority really is coming from requirements in the NCP. EPA often serves as the agency that's advocating for more public involvement and, you know, voicing the concerns of the community. But when it comes to enforcement, there isn't always a heavy hammer, so to speak, like a reg that you can point to and say you are not in compliance with X. It really comes down to collaboration. And trying EJ in itself is a large effort in collaboration, especially at our federal facility sites where you have your lead cleanup agency, regulatory agencies, all trying to address these concerns. So not a lot of hammers in that toolbox for enforcement, particularly with environmental justice and your community involvement plan. So just wanted to clarify that.
Okay. And Emmy, if it's okay, I just want to get in one quick clarifying question about some of the non-time critical removal action questions that we had in earlier. So one of the attendees wanted to know, what if EPA performs a non-time critical removal action? Okay. And they're doing it to conduct sampling at an offsite property. Does the NCP require notification to the CI?
So the NCP requirements, regardless if it's another federal agency who's a lead agency or if it's EPA, those requirements apply. Remember, though, if you're working at a federal facility, you probably have an administrative record that has existed for years or decades. So that notice isn't something you would put out again. But the requirements are the same as far as everything else that needs to be done, whether it's EPA or not. I hope that answers the question.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right. I think that's probably all the...
If we have a minute, I would like to make another point about environmental justice based on some of the comments that I saw. Mm-hmm. And that is, look, I think most people understand the concept of environmental justice, but they struggle with what do we do about it, right? Mm-hmm. And so I do want to say that FIFRO does have several pilot projects going on right now. One project that I'm involved with, I'm working with three federal facilities, three states, and EPA regional folks. And we're trying to do, you know, work through this question, like, what do we do step by step? How do we run EJ screen? How do we interpret the information? How do we change what we're doing? What does this look like? And I think, you know, like I said, people understand the concept, but it's going to take a little while to kind of get these tools into a toolkit so that everyone understands what they should be doing.
Definitely, Cal. It's not a short conversation. It's the beginning of a long one. All right. So we're going to switch gears now to community involvement in remedial actions. And first, we're going to start with community involvement requirements before your remedial investigation field activities. So for your remedial actions, you're going to need to conduct community interviews. These should help inform your community involvement plan. Like I mentioned, you still have to establish a local repository at or near the site and establish your administrative record file and make it available as part of the information repository. Also, publishing that notice in the newspaper of major circulation or other mechanisms to give notice of that. So similar requirements, we've heard a lot of these before. I want to talk about public notice for a second. When it's okay or required, I should say, to have public notice done through a newspaper and when it can be done by other means. So public notices being in newspapers are required when there's a proposed listing for a site to the NPL. When there's availability of the administrative record file and the information repository for that remedial action, the availability of the proposed plan with a brief analysis. I have seen a lot of newspaper postings or, you know, notices where it says the proposed plan is available for public comment, but there is no brief analysis of what's in the proposed plan. That needs to be part of the notice. That's how the reg is written. Also, if you issue a ROD, that a record of decision or an explanation of significant difference, the ESD, that needs a public notice in a paper. And if you have a proposed plan for a ROD amendment going out, also needs that notice. Again, these haven't changed. In 2015, EPA did make some changes to the NCP that allowed for other mechanisms besides a newspaper notice for some other items, but not for these. So this is a requirement. This is something you need to be aware of. If this is not done and you are not complying with the NCP, that could be problematic to your decision-making process and lead to delays. All right, so what are the other mechanisms that can be used and when can they be used? Well, if say a newspaper perhaps isn't the best way to get the word out, right? Perhaps you need to do social media postings or a website posting or all these other things that are out there. You can do this when you have additional files added to the administrative record for time-critical removal actions. If there's the availability of an ECA for a non-time-critical removal action, an NPL deletion, everything that is listed on the screen here, you can go ahead and use those other mechanisms, be it, are you going door-to-door with flyers? Perhaps there's not a lot of internet in the area you're at, but you want to get the word out. Mailing notices, email lists, all of these are potential options of other mechanisms to help get the word out to the public. All right. So coming back to our figure, this is the figure in the handbook for those recommended activities and required ones. Again, we have the, let me get my laser pointer here. We have an asterisk identifying what is required. And then if there, this decision is of more interest, you have these moderate level activities that can be done, be it preparing fact sheets, hosting that workshop, or other types of communications that might be helpful. Maybe you're gonna post short videos on your social media explaining something technical about the cleanup or how cleanup activities might affect traffic in the area or what have you. You know, those getting the information out more regularly. And if there's just a lot of public interest, if there isn't an established community advisory group, maybe you help establish that, or if there are existing groups or RABs and SSABs, attending those and making sure as a regulatory agency or state agency representative that you are present and participating in those conversations and offering the regulatory point of view as appropriate. All right. So let's go ahead and continue on to community involvement requirements for the proposed plan and your record of decision. Remember, you need to have that notice in the paper. You need to make sure that the proposed plan and all of its supporting information are in the administrative record. Again, not one record in a sea of thousands, but a file that's clearly identified for this remedial action. I highly recommend that if your agency is not doing this, you look into how to get this done because it is a big liability. So notice, or I should say, I had a proposed plan go out for public comment when we realized that the RIFS, the Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study, was not in fact available for the first few days of that public comment period. The link to it on the electronic administrative record was not working. So that affected our public comment period because the supporting information was not available to the public during that public comment period. We had to restart our clock, which ultimately, you know, led to delays in getting that record of decision issued. So this is a very important part of the process that you need to be aware of. Also required is providing a 30-day public comment period and notice. If there is significant request to extend that public comment period, the NCP states that it will be extended by at least 30 days, not 5 days, 10 days, 2 weeks. No, it says by at least 30 days. So I highly recommend you follow that since that's what's in the NCP. Also providing the opportunity for a public meeting. I often hear regulatory agencies saying you must have a public meeting. It is required. Well, for remedial actions, it actually isn't required in that sense, but you have to allow the opportunity for the public to request a public meeting. Using some common sense, if you know that this is a highly active site controversial decision and the public is just chomping at the bit to be involved, It makes sense to be proactive and plan your public meeting before you announce that the proposed plan is out and available for public comment. You might even want to have some workshops before the public comment period even starts to help educate the public on what the decision is or the options are. So again, if it makes sense, plan ahead, get your public meeting on the calendar and announce it with your other materials. If you're not sure because there has been limited interest in the site or in this particular activity, then when you issue that public, issue the proposed plan to the public, it can say, if you would like to request a public meeting, please contact so-and-so by X date. And then if it turns out there is a lot of interest, the agencies were expecting, you can still plan for a public meeting. Perhaps you have to extend your public comment period to accommodate having the meeting and then time to provide comments, but that's all should be flexible in your process. Also, if you have a public meeting, the NCP requires that you prepare a transcript of that meeting, which usually is done, written down the transcript word for word of what was said, and make it available to the public in the administrative record. How many of you have had a public meeting on a proposed plan where you followed up and made sure that transcript was put into the administrative record? I hope the answer is yes across the board, but I am assuming it might not be because a lot of people are not aware of that requirement. Yes, it's dated. Do we use written transcripts anymore? Maybe not, but the reg hasn't changed. So until it changes, it's a requirement. Also, having that responsiveness summary to the comments, it's going to be a chapter in your ROD. And lastly, making sure that you're publishing that notice of the record of decision in a newspaper. This figure, again, just summarizes those required activities with the asterisk and identifies, well, if you have a really interested community, how can you go further than just the requirements to ensure their needs are being met, that you're meeting with them? Do you need to have public meetings where other languages are available? Do you need to provide fact sheets or summary information in different languages? That kind of gets back to our environmental justice concerns. Know your community, know what their needs are, and make sure that they can be involved in the decision-making process based on their needs. So all of that is really important. I do want to touch base on the community involvement plan for just a second and acknowledge that the requirement is that you have one. There isn't a specific requirement on how often it should be updated. But again, common sense, if it's been 10 years since you looked at your community involvement plan and you don't even have the telephone number or the toll-free number where people can submit comments or ask questions, perhaps that needs to be updated to reflect what's actually going on at the site now. But again, great figure in the handbook that you can refer to. Now, I would like us to switch gears and test your understanding. We have some poll questions for everybody.
Okay, so we're going to pop open a new poll question, and this one is a true-false question asking, at a minimum, a 30-day public comment period is required on a proposed plan, and upon timely request, the lead agency will extend the public comment period by a minimum of 30 additional days. This is either true or false. And it does seem like people feel a bit more confident in answering this one, Emmy, from what I'm starting to see, which is excellent. About half of you have voted. Remember, we want to get to at least 2/3 or more. It is more fun if you participate and engage with our speakers to let them know how they're doing and what you're learning. And remember, you can continue to share your comments and questions in the Q&A as well if you have other clarifying statements on some of the test your understanding questions. All right, Emmy, I think I have gotten most of the responses that I'm going to get. So let me go ahead and close the poll down now and share those results. So overwhelmingly, the audience says it's true.
Yes, that is accurate. That is true.
Excellent.
Good job, everybody. And again, this is a common place where we don't follow the NCP. We go out for 30 days and we're like, let's tack on another 10 just because this community group asked us. No, the extension should be that additional 30 days. Or, that's a risk you're taking in your decision-making process. All right, let's go to the next question.
Okay, now this one is a multiple choice question asking, which one of these are conducted to gather information for a community involvement plan or CIP? and serve as a way to meet with community members and learn about their site-related needs, concerns, and expectations, as well as how the community gets information and prefers to receive site-related information. So you can select A, an action memo, B, a public meeting, C, a press release, D, a proposed plan, or E, community interviews. So you can only pick one of these options. Once you've clicked on the circle to the left of your preferred answer, then hit that submit button and that will cast your vote. About 40% of you have voted. We'll give you just a few moments longer to read through. And if you can't read everything in the Q&A poll pop-up box, go ahead and you can resize that poll window or move it out of the way. The complete question is on the screen on the slide. All right, just a few seconds more here. It does look like the answers are starting to slow down as they're coming in online. And I'm going to go ahead and end this poll here in just a second. So we'll count down 3, 2, 1. Look at those answers coming in as I count it down. All right, let's end it and take a look. So it appears as though the audience was primarily split between two answers. About 2/3 picked community interviews or option E, and then the other 30 to 40% selected B, public meetings. So what is the right answer?
So the right answer is actually E, community interviews, but I could see why people chose B, public meeting. If the public is coming to this meeting and you're engaging, you will be able to understand their needs, their concerns, and expectations. So I would say that I would give credit if this was a test, some partial credit for public meeting, but we were looking for E, community interviews.
Okay.
All right, let's go to our next question.
All right, and launching it now. So this is a fill in the blank statement. A blank of a public meeting held during a proposed plan, public comment period must be kept and made available to the public. Is the correct answer A, a transcript, B, a video recording, C, a photo log, D, a sign-in sheet, or E, an audio recording? So which one of these options that is made from a public meeting held during a proposed plan public comment period must be kept and made available to the public? And about half of them have sent their answers in and they seemed very confident in their answer. I feel like they clicked that letter with a smile. They know this one. I'm happy to see a quick response and it's very consistent. So let me go ahead and close this poll down now. And again, it looks like by far the overwhelming answer they selected was a transcript.
Yes. Very good, everyone. That is the correct answer.
All right.
All right, I think we have one more poll before we get into our case study, which I'm really excited is being presented today. So let's go to our last poll.
All right, and so now again, another fill in the blank statement. The lead agency must publish a blank for the following events. The public comment period on the proposed plan is held and the remedial alternative has been selected and the ROD is signed. Is it A, a responsiveness summary, B, a fact sheet, C, an action memo, D, a public notice, or E, a proposed plan? So you'll simply click the circle to the left of what you think is the right answer and hit your submit button in. Now, there seems to be some consensus in a chunk of the audience, and then a number of them are sort of unsure. So I think we're leading towards a trend. About half of the audience has voted. Remember, just take your best guess and hit that submit button. And then we can go ahead and talk about the answer. So as I'm starting to see responses slow down online, I'll give you just a second or two longer. 3, 2, 1. We'll go ahead and close this poll down and talk about those results. So it looks like about 2/3 of the audience selected D, a public notice. However, there were a number of people who thought it could also be A, B, or C, or even E. So what's the answer, Emmy?
So the answer we were looking for was D, public notice, as far as a requirement. However, I could see why people chose responsiveness summary, because that's where you're responding to comments and that has to be a part of the ROD when it's signed. So I think I know how people were thinking, and it makes sense to issue a fact sheet with your proposed plan and when the ROD is issued to help summarize that information for the public. So I get why people went with those, but we were looking for the public notice answer. So thanks everyone for participating in that. I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Natasha, who's bringing us a case study about some community involvement at a federal facility. Natasha, would you introduce yourself?
Hello, everyone. My name is Natasha Lowwater, and I'm an RPM, a federal facility RPM in Region 8 out of Denver. I'm currently on detail to FFRO, learning all kinds of things about PFAS going on across the country. One of my sites is Ellsworth Air Force Base, and Ellsworth Air Force Base is located in South Dakota. It was listed on the NPL in 1990, and I primarily want to talk about the community involvement activities at Ellsworth related to their PFAS investigations and impacts. They did have a RAB that was formed shortly after listing in the 1990s. And that RAB was active during the initial cleanup activities for TCE and related VOCs, but that RAB dissolved as those activities kind of got wrapped up, and they are still ongoing, but the off-base impacts aren't really happening anymore. So the RAB dissolved, and then PFAS entered the picture. So there was interest again. This particular base spans two counties in South Dakota, Meade County and Pennington County. So I'll be talking about those. So that's just some background on Ellsworth. Next slide. So I will be talking about community involvement activities that happened prior to the RIFS that were in relationship to some removal actions. However, the RIFS for PFAS is currently underway, and there have been a variety of activities happening to inform the public. There's not really a lot of engagement, I would say, kind of going back to one of those previous figures that Emmy shared. Next slide, please. So in 2016, the lifetime health advisories were released for PFOA and PFOS. And at that time, the base discovered that there were impacts to community members with private drinking water wells south and southeast of the base. And they took a time critical removal action, a TCRA, to provide both municipal water and these point of entry treatment systems in homes. Then they needed to decide how to create a permanent source of safe drinking water and took an NTCRA to provide municipal water. And that NTCRA included both a permanent source of clean drinking water to provide this water, and then the water lines to go to these particular impacted homes. There's approximately 200 homes that have been impacted. There was an ECA that had been released for public comment. And during this time, there were a variety of ways that the Air Force was reaching out to citizens. They had the formal public comment period on the ECA. They had offered one-on-one meetings to the public. And there was a pre-pandemic public meeting held in 2018 that was really well attended. That included leadership from the Air Force Civil Engineering Center, or AFCEC, as well as base leadership and EPA staff, and probably about 30 citizens attended that meeting. So there will be a formal public notice that will go out for any future public proposed plan. And there was a formal public notice in the newspaper for the ECA. I will also mention that while many of these private homes are kind of rural, spread out homes, there are several very low income trailer parks that had been impacted. However, they weren't flagged as environmental justice communities using EJ screen. So there was concern from EPA's standpoint about EJ, but not necessarily from the Air Force, because the tools that we have weren't flagging it. So just kind of an interesting side note. So next slide. This is an image of the base on the left and the extent of current known PFAS migration off the base. Most of the PFAS impacts, or most of the homes, I should say, that have been impacted by PFAS are south of the base, and then also kind of trailing off east, but most of the impacts are south of the base. So the Air Force did not want to host another public meeting. They felt it was very resource intensive and actually didn't provide a lot of benefit. So they felt that they have a periodic newsletter that gets a quarterly newsletter that gets mailed to people directly. And during the public notice for the ECA, had offered one-on-one meetings. Partly this was also due to COVID concerns and not wanting to hold an in-person meeting. I had offered at many of our project manager meetings some other alternatives at that, you know, in 2020, we were starting to do a lot more virtual meetings. However, this community is primarily older and may not be very tech savvy or even have internet access. So that platform was not used. They also, during these meetings, had conveyed to me, that the Air Force had conveyed to me, that they did not want to reinstate the RAB. So when I was personally contacted by a private citizen whose drinking water was impacted and his agricultural wells were impacted, we came up with some ways to try to compel the Air Force to reinstate the RAB, because in his understanding, there was a lot of community interest in reinstating the RAB. So he prepared a letter that came, I believe it was jointly from the Pennington County and Meade County commissioners. And then I wrote a letter supporting reinstatement of the RAB. So he sent that letter with EPA's letter to the Air Force asking for the RAB to be reinstated. The base wing commander for the Ellsworth Air Force Base declined to reinstate the RAB, citing regulations at 32 CFR Part 202. Which state that there must be sufficient and sustained interest and of one of like four factors to satisfy reinstating the RAB. One of those was that there was a formal request from local government. So this was why we sent the letter, to help the local government get the RAB reinstated. However, the base wing commander felt that there wasn't sufficient and sustained interest. So trying to think outside the box, how do we get the community what they want? They want a public meeting. The Air Force didn't want to provide a public meeting. They wanted to reinstate their app. The Air Force declined to do that too. So we came up with this idea of holding a town hall. It didn't really feel appropriate for EPA to host the town hall because we're not the lead agency. So we had we encouraged the county commission to host the public meeting in their chambers. And at the time we held it in March of 2022. Can you go to the next slide, please? We decided to hold it virtually. So it was hosted on Zoom. I attended virtually, as did the other EPA site team members. And there was a lot of participation. There were probably 30 people in the room, maybe another 10 citizens who had attended virtually. There were 15 regulators between the state and the Air Force in the room, as well as all the other EPA site team to attend. I gave a presentation on just Superfund 101. What's the process? Where does the public enter into the process? What are the different types of community involvement opportunities? I invited ATSDR to give a presentation on the background of PFAS and then some of the environmental assessments or exposure assessments that they're conducting at federal facilities across the country. The community's main interest is what is happening with PFAS in their agricultural waters. So they are using this water not only for drinking, which is now being provided through bottled water or point of entry treatment systems, but there is no treatment or replacement of their agricultural water. So that really is the primary interest of the community. The Air Force also presented about their PFAS remedial investigation, and as well as all the other activities that are happening still on base with TCE and other VOCs, as well as radioactive waste. And then the state presented about their permitting process and kind of what to expect with their permitting process. So it went off really well. It was very well accepted. People were excited about it. We are in the process of organizing another one, probably next month or in November. So I think in conclusion, I just want to say there's lots of ways to provide the community what they need, and thinking outside the box and utilizing some of the suggestions that Emmy and Cal have shared have been just really excellent ways to engage.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Natasha. It's always great to see real world problems and how we're trying to address them, especially with PFAS that is showing up more and more in our conversations and how to get the community involved in those decisions. So thank you so much for that. I'm going to just check in with Jean. I think we're going to try and hold questions till the end. So let's get through the rest of our section so we can try and answer some of your questions. I want to touch base on what about community involvement post record of decision? What are those requirements? So if you have your record of decision and it turns out you're going to have something happen that will affect it post ROD, then there will be varying levels of community involvement depending on what the change is. So if your post-ROD change is an insignificant or minor change, then it just might be a memo to the project file on your administrative record. If it's a significant change and you have to issue an ESD, there's a set of requirements for that. And if it's a fundamental change where you're going with a ROD amendment, you're basically going back to the starting point of your community involvement efforts. So let's look at these individually. Like I said, insignificant change. Perhaps you were going to use 5 millimeter size gravel and you ended up having to use 10 millimeter size gravel as a liner in your cap or what have you. You know, it's something, yes, it was a change, but the remedy is still the same. But if you have a significant change to the remedy, and you'll have to issue an ESD. And we have a whole separate webinar on when that's required if you're asking that question. So you have to make the ESD and any supporting information available in the administrative record and the information repository. And when it's issued, you have to issue that public notice in a major newspaper of general circulation. Again, if there are absolutely no newspapers in general circulation around your site, perhaps you have to go with an online newspaper. I think that's justifiable. But if there is a print newspaper still active in the area, then that's the newspaper you would go with. One thing I want to identify, this is the minimum you do for an ESD. Your site team really should be working together to identify the community's needs and identify if it would be appropriate to do more, issue a fact sheet, maybe have a public meeting or a webinar on this decision. It doesn't have to be the minimum requirements if your community is asking for more. if you're going to do a ROD amendment, it's a fundamental change to the remedy, you are essentially going back to what you did for your initial record of decision. You had to publish a notice in the paper, have your public comment period, offer the opportunity for a public meeting. If one is held, keep a transcript, do your responsiveness summary, and when the ROD is signed or the ROD amendment is signed, issue that notice of availability. So it's very similar to the ROD process. Again, we have our handy figure, which identifies those required items with an asterisk, and then other things that you can do at the moderate level or high level of community involvement. Again, I worked on a site where we were dealing with plutonium contamination, and initially there was a very draft proposed plan. We decided, hey, let's have a workshop. So we came out with the workshop and said, all right, we're looking to cap these sites in place because we know plutonium isn't going to travel the groundwater. Ooh, so the public did not agree at that workshop. It was an upheaval of how dare you leave this radioactive waste here? How dare you threaten our children's lives? So it was very not popular, to say the least. So guess what? The lead agency went back to reanalyze the alternatives. And ultimately, when that proposed plan was finalized and issued to the public, the preferred alternative identified was to dig out the plutonium to a certain depth to allow for surface land use and not cap it in place. So that's a great example of when doing more can affect great change. Because imagine that workshop wasn't held and we just said, nah, we're going to cap it in place as a preferred remedy. And there was this huge outcry. It would have been stickier doing it earlier in the process. There was more flexibility to adapt and change the path forward. And we ended on a remedy that was supported by the community. So that's just one example. I'm going to switch to 5-year reviews, and Cal is actually going to tell us about these.
Yeah, thanks, Emmy. So Section 121 of CERCLA requires that any remedial actions that result in waste in place, right? You're leaving any hazardous substances, pollutants, and contaminants on site, that it be subjected to a 5-year review. So this is an important process. The 5-year review allows everyone to step back and evaluate the implementation of the remedy, the performance of the remedy, or if any site conditions have changed that call into question the protection of human health and the environment. So for federal facility sites, the lead agency, that would be DOD, DOE, et cetera, conducts the review, prepares the reports, and submits the report for EPA to EPA in the state for review and comment. The lead agency is responsible for ensuring that the recommendations and follow-up actions are completed. No community involvement activities during operation and maintenance or the 5-year review are mandated in CERCLA or addressed in the NCP. But is it a good idea? Always. So 5-year reviews undertaken by the lead federal agency should include notifying the community that the review will be conducted, requesting information from the community about the site, notifying the community that the review has been completed, and preparing a summary of the review and making it available at the local administrative record repository and or on a web page. So, this is an opportunity to hear from the community. And the other thing is that 5 years is, enough time that you may see some community turnover. So it may be appropriate at the site-specific level to get out there and assess, like, if there was turnover, if there are new members of the community, if community groups have changed. Maybe perhaps update the community involvement plan. It's a time of reckoning, and it can be a good time of reckoning for community involvement as well. You can poll the community, go out there and do interviews. Those interviews can be captured in the 5-year review. It can be very informative. We in the federal facilities headquarters review every five-year review that is produced. And as such, we're looking for, did they reach out to the community? Is there community feedback? And if there's community feedback, what is it? What did they do about it? Did they, a lot of times we see, community member expresses concerns and there was never any response. There, maybe they don't have to, but still, it's a best practice. And if you want to build trust, if you want meaningful engagement, you take this seriously. It's not just like a checklist. Other things you could do is, let's see. So there is a guidance, 2001 comprehensive five-year review guidance. And so that is a very useful document to pull up. The team should consider conducting that additional community involvement activities, especially if it's a high profile site, like Emmy pointed out, like some sites, they're hot. And you want to get out there and engage the public. You also may choose to notify local public officials and the local primary health agency, leadership of any relevant neighborhood and civic groups. So there are options and there are opportunities. So I think that for the federal facility, other federal agencies that are on the call, like take this seriously. This is a really good opportunity to outreach, to reach out to the community, and for EPA folks, support this. Let's see. There are some useful links in the handouts that you were provided. So I think that's it. We're on to another poll.
It's our last poll, so people will probably be happy about that. So Jean, will you take us through it?
Absolutely. So I have the last and final poll up on the screen, which is a true-false statement. A five-year review requires a notice be published in a newspaper of major circulation. Is that statement true or false? Simply click the circle next to the answer and then hit the submit button. It looks like about half of you have voted. We'll still aim for that goal of about two-thirds of the audience. We appreciate everyone hanging on until the end, and then we will jump into our Q&A break here shortly. So take your best guess and then hit the submit button. And now that I see the answers are slowing down just a bit, let me go ahead and close this one out and let's talk through the results. So it looks like about two-thirds said it's true, but a third of the audience said it's false. What's the answer?
All right. So the key part of this question is requires. Is it a requirement? Technically, it is not a requirement in the NCP. Is it a good idea? Should we be doing this? Absolutely. And maybe the newspaper isn't the best way. Perhaps it's social media, the website, YouTube videos, whatever it may be. Get the word out. What good is a report if no one knows it exists and no one ever reads it? So, always, yes, good idea. Highly recommend. All right, folks, we're going to go into communication tools. We do want to try and leave some time for Q&A, so I'm going to go through this pretty quickly to get to some of your questions. As far as communication tools, the handbook I've mentioned, there's a website associated with the handbook that EPA manages. Great information there. It's in your participant manual. You can click right on those links from the PDF. But when it comes to community involvement planning, I want to touch on the community involvement plan really quickly. It really is meant to be the backbone of community involvement. It should specify the activities that are going to be conducted at the site, how they're going to be conducted. It should identify the community, their demographics, other needs that wouldn't be caught in what you typically see in a Census Bureau report. Really getting into how are we managing public involvement day to day at this site? What are the expectations? So again, all of this to say, update your community involvement plans so that they reflect what you're actually doing. There's no use for this document if it never gets updated or read and if no one even knows that it exists, be it the public or even, you know, other federal and state agencies and contractors who work on the site. It should be a resource for everyone. As far as a communication strategy, be it a single event or a short-term event, it's really good to consider if this is appropriate for you all, especially when you have multiple agencies. So if the press is reaching out to DOD and EPA and the state and everyone is saying something different, that probably will not end well. So if there's a communication strategy where we've agreed on talking points and how we're going to discuss what's happening at the site, that is really going to make everyone look more efficient, or what's the right word, effective at their jobs and conducting cleanup at the site. So with your community involvement plan, there should be major components of it. Again, check to see if yours has this. Are you talking about a brief history of the site and its description? Do you have an up-to-date community profile? As Cal said, that can change. There's turnover. Don't assume the one you did 20 years ago is still accurate today. It probably isn't. Is there the site action plan, your FFA, those milestones that we mentioned earlier? Do people know how to access that? And has the community been able to comment on this document and its updates? If not, that would make sense. It's a how we're communicating with them. Having input and feedback from the community is really, you know, makes a lot of sense. So there is a fact sheet. There's a link to it in your participant manual that talks about community involvement plans in more detail if you're looking for how to make yours better. We also have fact sheets that can be used as a communication tool. Again, it should be brief and to the point, plain language, easy to read. If you have a fact sheet that's 10 pages long, it's no longer helpful to the general public. 2 pages, 2 to 4 pages is kind of, you know, the sweet spot. You got to get it concise, get that technical explanation, those alternatives down, synthesized to a plain language approach that everyone can understand. Why should they care? Get it to those very brief statements where anyone walk, you know, anyone you meet on the street could read and comprehend what it is you're doing at the site. And also, maybe just posting a print fact sheet isn't helpful. What if we made a video to accompany that fact sheet? A 1-minute YouTube video or something you could post on social media explaining what the fact sheet has. That's going to be much more effective in today's technology age than a PDF, in my opinion. Speaking of social media, that's another great way to communicate with the public. When travel is difficult, you can still get the word out. You can share videos, photos, all sorts of information very easily on your social media page. And you can even allow for conversations to happen with the community there. And at a minimum, allows you to give frequent updates on what's happening at the site. So some things you have to consider, though, does your community have access to internet to rely on social media? Are you able to include live streams of public meetings? So maybe people can't get there themselves, but they can participate virtually doing that hybrid approach, because some people really like to meet in person still, even though it's not always possible. And are translation services required? Do you have a large part of the community, or maybe a small but concentrated part of the community, that needs to hear this information in a different language? All good things to consider. And again, we at EPA have a fact sheet specific to social media if you're looking for more information. We're going to switch gears to some online tools, and Cal's going to talk about these briefly.
Yeah, I'm going to run through this real quick. EJ Screen. The more I use this tool, the more I like it. It's fairly user-friendly. There are reports that you can pull up fairly easily if you pick a location, identify a radius, click, you know, produce a report, and you have a starting point. But there's so much more here because it incorporates information from the 10-year census, the American Community Survey, which is updated every 5 years, and then all the good environmental data that EPA collects. So you can look at all these factors individually and some in combination. And so it really gives you a sense of who might be disproportionately impacted. And though while it was developed for you know, environmental justice related uses. You know, it's just, I just find it generally useful. But just one example, like you can dig deeper and you can identify languages spoken in the area. So for example, in an agricultural area in Delaware, adjacent to one of the federal facilities we're looking at, we find high levels of people speaking Creole French. And it was like, oh, we didn't know that. And so then the state goes out and starts engaging folks and finding people in those communities so that they could bring them to the table and we could all have, you know, a conversation to assess needs and interests and concerns, right? So that's EJ Screen. And it just a reminder, it's a starting point, not an ending point. It doesn't give you answers. It raises all these questions that you need to then go ground truth. And ground truthing is getting out there and meeting people. Another tool that I'd like to talk about, cleanups in my community. This kind of consolidates a lot of information on impacted geographies. So impaired waters, TRI, toxics release inventory locations. So that's who's releasing toxics into the environment. Tribal areas, brownfield sites, RCRA sites, Superfund sites, private and federal facility. So what this is really helpful, like someone mentioned earlier in one of the questions that, you know, what about these communities that are impacted by multiple sites? Well, you can find them by using this type of map. So it's very interesting and informative. Next slide, please. FedFacts. This is our very own website that has information on federal facilities that are in or on the hazardous waste compliance docket or the docket, right? So CERCLA 120C requires that EPA establish a docket which contains information reported to EPA by federal facilities that manage hazardous waste or which from hazardous substances, pollutants, or contaminants have been or may be released. So that's a mouthful. But so there are, you know, hundreds of sites on this docket. Not every one of them moves on to the Superfund list. But the docket allows EPA to kind of assess the sites and determine if they're candidates to be listed as Superfund sites. Anyway, this tool allows you to pull up any one of the docket facilities, and it provides a dashboard information, a lot of information on the site, the hazardous contaminants that may be present there. Bonus, it connects to EJ Screen. So you can pull up one of these sites and click on the EJ Screen report, and it will deliver you an EJ Screen report live. Just pull the data from the EJ Screen website. So it is solely federal facility sites. So unlike cleanups in my community, you don't get the other RCRA sites and private sites that may be surrounding. So those are three web-based resources that I would recommend that you explore. And they're on each website associated with those tools. There's lots of information on how to use the tools. So that's also a good starting point, including some YouTube videos, et cetera. So I'll stop there. I know we're pressed for time. Sorry, Annie.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Cal. So I'm going to touch just for a second on EPA technical assistance available. I mentioned earlier that the lead agency is responsible for funding community involvement, providing the resources, the people that are required to do all of that. However, there have been instances where EPA has issued grants to groups at federal facilities. So those are typically TAG grants, technical assistant grants, where we've issued them to a group at a federal facility so that they can get help with understanding a technical document or helping understand a cleanup alternative better or technology better. So those are available. There is a website EPA has specific to technical assistant grants if groups are interested in applying for that. Note, your community involvement plan should also mention the availability of TAGs to community groups, even at federal facilities. So I'll just let that sit there so we can go into our review and really into questions, because we have a few minutes left together and I think some good questions have come in. So Jean, can we jump on those?
We absolutely, we can. So we're going to go ahead and jump into some of these questions, and I'm going to get all of my speakers here just so that we can help. So there were a few questions that came in earlier as I'm scrolling through, and there were a number of them here about public notices. Okay. So one of the attendees was just curious, if we have a public notice, can that go to an online newspaper posting, or does it need to be physically printed for distribution?
So if there is the original intent was that it would be a physical newspaper that's being distributed in the area. So if one exists, that's what should likely be used. But if there is not a newspaper of general circulation in your area, and that really is the only way you can publish something in a newspaper, even though it's online, then you could justify going with that approach. But until that changes in the NCP, the requirement remains as it is.
Okay. And could you possibly revisit the other requirements for other public notice methods versus the newspaper requirement again?
So actually, there is a list of those in the participant manual. I know if you were trying to write those down, we went pretty quickly, but there was a PDF in the chat. You can just download that and everything should be there, plus additional notes and hyperlinks for that information.
All right, excellent. And I will put that link back in the chat right now. And for those of you that might be replaying the recorded version, the link that we're including is part of the seminar homepage. So that would have been shown at the beginning of the recording, and I'm going to show it again at the end of the recording. So if you are watching the recorded version, don't worry. We will get you that link when we close out today's webinar. Emmy, can you clarify a question about the administrative record? Are you referring to the lead agency's AR, or what they can find on EPA site profile page?
So when we've been saying administrative record today, that is referring to the administrative record maintained by the lead agency. EPA site profile pages will have some summary information, but it is not the location to find documents associated to cleanup for a federal facility site.
Okay. Okay. And we did have a comment that came in about the different versions of whether or not we're doing online publication notifications versus print publication notifications. And we've brought in elements of EJ considerations. And one attendee noted that a lot of times print publications can cost money. So they found in their lower income communities, online sources are more readily available. And that's why they were looking to see if those online sources were acceptable. So just wanted to share that comment with you.
The requirement to print something in the newspaper doesn't mean you can't do other things. You should be doing what's going to meet the needs of your community, definitely.
Okay. Regarding the public meetings and then community interviews, mm-hmm. would you say that hosting those public meetings will then help you decide in who you should be including in your community interviews?
Hosting those public meetings can definitely help you identify who would be appropriate to interview. Maybe they self-nominate or they know of people in the community who have really good information related to your site. So that is one way. You could also send out an email, listserv, or postcards to people in, you know, whatever radius of the site saying if they're interested in participating in community interviews. There's different ways you could go about it.
Okay. And we did have a question about 5-year reviews. So Cal, this one might be for you. One of the commenters said that I thought the 5-year obligation remains until a site is unrestricted for use, regardless of whether or not contaminants remain in place or removed. Is that true?
Yeah, it is unlimited use, unrestricted exposure. I think it's UUUE. And so that is definitely the benchmark, and that's generally associated with waste in place above certain risk-based levels. So, you know, there's no such thing as zero. You don't get down to zero, But you know, once you get below those risk-based triggers, then you may be eligible for UUUE, which would take you out of the five-year review process.
And that's basically the only requirement in the NCP, the requirement to do a five-year review, but the community involvement aspects are not identified there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I do want to acknowledge there's been a number of comments and dialogues and sort of general questions about how communities define themselves, how individuals are identifying as members of community, the best ways to interact with them, the use of social media and other digital ways, and just some of the challenges they've experienced and comments they've received. So there's a lot of dialogue in there, probably too much to get into, but I did want to sort of acknowledge that there is a lot of question about that and dialogue about that. And so, Emmy, I think it might lead perfectly to what you have up on the screen. If they have specific questions about what might work best at their site or how some of these communication or notification tools could be used, what should they do?
If you would like to ask additional questions or have a conversation on community involvement at federal facilities, please feel free to reach out to me. You can shoot me an email or give me a call. I'd be happy to talk more with you all about it. And for EJ information, I would refer you to EPA's EJ website, but Cal is also a resource if you have questions specific to that. And Cal, you're a risk assessor by training, right? So you speak the language if people have questions on that front.
All right, excellent. I know we have reached our scheduled end time. So I think, Emmy, if it's all right, I'm going to walk through just a few final reminders before we close things out today, if that's okay. So I'll go ahead and take control here and walk through a couple of reminders because there were some questions that came in regarding the availability of presentation materials and certificates and recordings. So I'm going to walk through a few reminders here and then close out our session for today. So very quickly, the presentation materials have already been posted. They're part of something that's known as the participant manual, and those were available on the seminar homepage. I'm going to show you that URL one more time. But for those of you who are here live, they're already posted in the chat. So you can scroll through the meeting chat and access them through a direct link there. If you have to hop off, we sent you a link to the seminar homepage in your confirmation and reminder emails. It's the same place you went in when checking in for today's webinar. Remember, today's session was part of an ongoing internet seminar series that's being hosted by the Federal Facilities Office here at EPA. So we are going to carry on with this series next month on October 12th when we look at the role of Superfund performance measures. So you can participate in any of these webinars live online, or you can replay the recorded versions once we archive and post those up. So we encourage you, these are open to the public. Please share them with your colleagues. And then if you can, there is an optional 3-day in-person training classroom, which is open to a restricted audience of states, tribes, and federal regulators, that if you're able to do all of the online classes and to qualify and complete that in-person training, you have access to receive a Federal Facilities Academy certificate. If you have questions on those certificates, you can talk to Emmy or I will be happy to walk you through the requirements. So as I noted earlier, we hosted today on the Cleanup Information Network, and we would love to have you connect with us at cluin.org. And be sure to sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month and highlights free online sessions like today's seminar. Now, the seminar homepage where you can find out all sorts of information about today's webinar is the URL here shown in red. That is available from today forward. It's where you went to register. It's where you can go to access the materials. Just scroll down on that page and you'll find links to learn more about our presenters. Contact information can be found there. And then there are sections where you can download the slides and related resources. There's even a reference document that has a whole bunch of the links that were highlighted that's also available as well. Just make sure that you're using the plus and minus icons on the side to expand and collapse various sections to find the content that you need. If you are looking for a participation certificate for today's session, you can receive one after you submit feedback. So visit that seminar homepage. One of the last sections on the seminar homepage is our feedback form. If you click that section and fill out the feedback form, making sure you fill in your email address correctly and you check the box at the bottom of that form certifying you are here for the entire online delivery, as soon as you submit your certificate, you'll then have access to a participation as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll have access to the certificate that documents your participation. You can download it and print it from the confirmation screen. I usually recommend everyone to do that. We will also try to email it to you, but sometimes those emails can get caught by junk or spam filters. So it's always nice to just download it as soon as you see it on the confirmation screen. If you had multiple people join at your location, each person can fill out the feedback form from that seminar homepage. They don't need to have registered individually. Anyone can share feedback. So I simply ask those of you who did register, make sure you get a copy of the link to the seminar feedback page and share that with the colleagues who joined you so they can fill the form out themselves and get their own certificate of participation. And if you happen to be one of the lucky people replaying the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still visit the seminar homepage. It is shown here in red and fill out that feedback form. Or right about now in the recorded version, there should be a feedback button right above my head in the online archive that you can click, which will open up the form. You can still share your feedback based off of the replay, making sure you check the box you replayed the whole thing. And then when you submit your feedback, you'll get your own participation certificate that you can save for your own records. The recording from today's session should be available in about 1 week. You'll automatically receive an email from me when that is available. So with those final reminders, I want to thank all of the organizers and presenters who joined us for today's session and shared their expertise, along with the over 125 individuals who joined us live for today's session. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and you'll join us on a future internet seminar. With that, I'll go ahead and formally conclude today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.